Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and tonight we got a very special guest for you. We're going to, as always, talk about some delicious wild fishing game, as well as his cookbook, which he released last year. But first, before we introduce our guests and get into that, we'll get some of our news out of the way. So, updates for me, antelope season is in full swing here in Colorado, and I will be chasing antelope this weekend. Been honing in my archery skills. That's kind of the big deal for me. Did some cooking in the cooking classes. I attended Ara's, Flaming Hot Cheeto Scotch Egg cooking class that he did last night, which was remarkable. We had good participation. I think there was like five or six people on that. But we're rolling through with these cooking classes every week. And I don't see that we're going to end them anytime soon, because I like doing them. They're fun, interactive. People learn to hone their wild game skills a little more. And the plan is down the road to get maybe some butchering techniques and some more like in-depth kitchen technique stuff too. I know people appreciate that. But with that, you can go down in the show notes and click the link that'll be titled the Harvesting Nature Supper Club, which is that little venue that we're operating our cooking classes out of. And so those are virtual online, as well as you can go back and you can purchase the on-demand versions of the class so that you can watch it in your leisure as many times as you want. So those are available there too. All those show notes, or all those links, are down in the show notes. No big deal. Adventures for Food Podcast, did one of those a couple weeks ago. A little spearfishing adventure. That was super fun. Hanging out with sharks and lionfish and all that stuff. I would say there's not many things I do that I enjoy tangling with sharks, but lionfish are delicious. Probably one of my favorite fish to eat out there. So it makes it kind of worth it in the end. As long as you don't get bit or stung, I guess, by the lionfish. So as always, you can buy us a cup of coffee. Help us fuel those long nights of podcast editing, article writing, recipe cooking, venture planning. So click that link there in the show notes, and we're always happy for a donation of a cup of Joe. But I'll go over to Colin. Colin, what you got going on in your neck of the woods?
Hey, everyone. It's Colin. Not too much really going on here. I was actually back home in Pennsylvania for a few days, going to a wedding, and haven't really done much in the outdoors back there. That was mostly just catching up with family and stuff. But we do have some seasons coming up. I think I said in the last podcast that I was on that bear season started here back in the beginning of August. We got September goose starts in September. I'm doing a pheasant workshop in what?
Imagine that. September goose starts in September.
Yeah, I guess that, I didn't need to tell you that. I'm doing a pheasant workshop. So, ODFW, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, they started putting on these, skills classes and hunting workshops. And, I did the skills course for it. It's a prerequisite. And it's like basic shotgun skills. I mean, it's like how, these are the parts, these are the gauges, this is what gauge and cartridge means, this is how you load it, all that stuff. And then you actually go out to the range with some volunteer but professional coaches, and you just shoot clays for like 4 hours. It was really awesome. I learned a whole lot. I mean, I've shot a shotgun plenty of times before, but just like how to follow it with your eye and everything. You aim by not aiming. Yeah, really neat. And then I'm actually doing the pheasant workshop with them in September, the day that early deer season opens here and goose season. But I'm going to this pheasant workshop because they have like guides with you with dogs and everything, and they like tell you when to shoot, and they stock it with pheasants the week before. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's like, I think it was like $75 for the course and this workshop. So, I mean, imagine what it costs to get an actual pheasant guide out there with a dog on your own dime. Like, it's a really sweet deal. I'm looking forward. They have one for ducks coming up. They have one for turkey. They have one for fly fishing. So I'm going to sign up for all of them pretty much and go to all of them. Really looking forward to them.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's a good way too, especially for you as like an adult onset hunter to get in there and both meet people and hone your skills. I was thinking back when I was in high school, I used to shoot skeet, our like FFA chapter, which is Future Farmers of America, which obviously I'm not a farmer, but I was at one point, which is where that played in. But we had a skeet shooting team, and we would go to state competitions and national competitions, and I really learned to shoot skeet well there, and I think that played well because the dove season and then the duck season following that year was just phenomenal as far as the way we were out to get the harvest game, just because you spent so much time like shooting, just like anything, you practice. But I don't know if a lot of upland game hunters maybe overlook that fact, or maybe they do in the off season shoot a lot of skeet, but I think it's a great skill to maintain, both in the off season and during the season too, if you've got some downtime.
Yeah, definitely. I wrote a short article on it. I think it's going to come out this week or next week, about the whole, just the shotgun skills course. And then I'll write a follow up one after the pheasant workshop. But,
cool.
I mean, there were six people in the course, six students. And, I think it was myself and one other guy who had shot a shotgun before, and there was one other person who had shot just any gun in general before. So half the class hadn't even shot a gun before, and four of them had shot a shotgun before. And by the end of it, everybody was hitting clays. So it was pretty,
That's pretty awesome.
I think ODFW really has the right idea with this, this program for, you know, the R3 and getting people into it and keeping people back, getting people back into it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super cool.
The only thing I find about shooting clays all summer is you should use the same gun that you hunt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I shot all summer one year with a field double barrel break action. And then when I switched to my semi-automatic, the action is like 4 inches longer than a break action. And it's the same. So then I go to using a gun that's 4 inches longer, and opening day duck season, I like missed like half the shots I took.
Oh, wow.
And then, so now I've ended up getting a break action like clay gun that is a 30-inch barrel that kind of, with extended chokes, it kind of matches my semi-auto that I hunt with in length. So it swings the same.
Yeah.
But that was, I couldn't figure out what it was. And I thought, you know, it's probably switching between these two guns that are 4 inches different in size.
It's crazy how much, you know, a slight difference like that makes. But wow. Yeah, that's a good
point.
It
was funny. It messed me up one year.
That's just my last note about it. That was another thing that I really liked about it. They had some over-under break action and semi-autos. So you could kind of like feel which one you're more comfortable with, or, you know, wanted to go with a classic over-under, or if you wanted to go with a fancy semi-auto. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're putting a plug out there for Benelli, but man, that thing was smooth.
Yeah, they're nice.
Yeah,
they're real nice.
I thought it was really cool. I'm really looking forward to the next couple.
So you're gonna are you gonna invest in a?
I might have to. It was a 20 gauge too, and I have a 12 gauge. So Michael, like you were saying, it's not quite the same gun. So I don't know. I might have to, you know, get in line with what they're teaching. But
I think you get to a point where it doesn't matter what you're holding.
Yeah.
You know, if you can shoot, you can shoot, but. Yeah, I started archery hunting in my early 20s, late teens, before I really got into guns. And it hasn't been for, you know, the last couple of years I've really started to get in, you know, I really enjoy using firearms as opposed to archery. Okay. I still love archery, but I kind of like, I think I've done it kind of backwards. You know, the way a lot of people do, they start out with guns and they kind of move to archery. You know, now, you know, the amount of time I have to hunt is getting shorter and shorter sometimes with work. And when I see a deer or whatever it is 150 yards away and I can't get to it with my bow, you know, I'd much rather just have a rifle now.
Yeah.
And fill my freezer, you know, than have that buck get away and try and stalk this thing. And it's where I live, it's very hard to archery hunt. So
gotcha.
I do this. So this year is actually my first year into archery. I've been primarily a rifle hunter my whole life. Like, I've owned a bow. I still have the bow my grandfather bought me when I was like 12 years old, and I've been carrying it around as I moved around the country for, you know, what, 20 years now. And it's just like, I don't know, it never struck a fancy with me until I got out here to Colorado, and I'm just like, there's so many opportunities and the archery season is so large and long that I was like, I should probably pick up a bow and get started.
And it's cool and I love it and I have a lot of respect for it. But where I live specifically, the whitetail deer population seems to be going down as the coyote population rises. And that and losing hunting permission on properties is becoming harder and harder to archery hunt. And I've, you know, I've sat on these, some of these farms I have permission and I won't see a deer all year. So I'll just go out with a rifle somewhere and shoot one. So, but I still love archery, but yeah, if it comes down to it, I really just want to fill the freezer.
Yep. Efficiency. I understand completely. I'm like,
it's kind of how I like to turkey hunt. You know, I'll shoot my first one with a shotgun and get that out of the way. And then I'll go out with a bow afterwards.
Huh. See, I didn't think about that. That's a good strategy too.
We'll have to just get one, because we get two tags where I live. So, you know, kill one, get it in the fridge, and then mess around with the bow.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've heard his voice now in the background, so I'll go ahead and give him an introduction. So he is a Canadian-born, professionally trained chef and the co-owner of Antler Kitchen and Bar. He's a hunter, forager, husband, and father. And back in 2000, as I mentioned earlier, he published the Hunter Chef Cookbook, which features a collection of over 100 recipe and butchery guides. Michael Hunter, welcome to the Wild Fishing Game Podcast, officially.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So, really excited. I mean, we have a little bit of history that people may not know. Like, I think we got a couple of your articles floating around on the Harvest in Nature website from, like, back
2015 or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, 2015. the humble beginnings. It was awesome. I was reading through some of those the other day. It's good stuff. It's always good to go back and read the I guess what people call the vintage stuff now. But no, it's cool. I'm glad we were able to connect and get you on the show. So definitely want to hit on your cookbook, talk a lot about wild food, because it's a great opportunity to chat with you about that. But for those that may not know you or know your story, can you kind of tell a little bit more about yourself and your journey, hunting, culinary, anything you want to spell in there? We're all ears.
Yeah. Well, I guess my introduction to the outdoors is growing up on a farm. I grew up on a horse farm north, about an hour north of Canada's largest city, Toronto. And, you know, I just, as a kid, you know, ran around in the mud and had, you know, dogs and cats and horses, and I just love being outside. And I remember going to school and taking field trips and learning about you know, we did a trip into a forest one year, and I think it had something to do with maple syrup, but also the leeks, since the wild leeks started coming out of the ground. And I remember, you know, they showed us and all these little kids are eating, you know, these wild onion / wild leeks, and the bus just reeked like our onion breath on the way home. And I was just, you know, I love the outdoors. I was raised in the outdoors, and but no one in my family hunted for food. It was my introduction to hunting was through horses, where my mom was a member of a riding club where they would fox hunt on horseback.
Wow.
So you know, it's a, my mom has an English background, and that's the sport in England. Mm-hmm. And here it's not so much foxes, it's the coyote population. So the hounds would, you know, there's a huntsman with a horn that blows the horn, and the hounds kind of listen to him through the horn. And, you know, he's got a pack of hounds, and then there's the field behind him. He's got a couple guys that help with the hounds. They're called whips. And then there's the, you know, all the members of the hunt would ride, you know, behind. And we did that for sport. And, you know, farmers would call the hunt club to come to their land and hunt just as a service to help them and give the hunt club, you know, permission to ride and have fun on their property. And so that was my introduction to hunting. And the huntsman of this hunt club ended up taking me turkey hunting when I was 18. And I thought turkeys were just domesticated farm animals. I didn't know they were in the wild. And at this point, I had been cooking at a couple diners locally. I got a job in a restaurant when I was 13. And I was very interested in food. I was gardening. I had watched the movie Food Inc. and was very kind of, you know, newly passionate about, mm-hmm. you know, eating organic and, you know, became aware of factory farming and, you know, antibiotics and growth hormones and food and all these things that, you know, we didn't really know about. And it's when I went hunting for the first time for wild turkey that I really got to taste the difference between how a turkey should taste and farm turkey. And it really just blew my mind. And as a young chef and really curious mind, I was just, you know, I'm totally obsessed with hunting right from then on. It was, you know, I didn't want to eat, you know, farm raised anything at that point. This is how, you know, hunting is how food is supposed to taste. Mm-hmm. And it's really just how kind of it all began.
Nice. And, you know, I love to hear that, especially amongst chefs who hunt and hunters who are chefs. Mm-hmm. That really, it kind of tells that story piece. And I think that's something we all sort of appreciate, is like it paints the picture from, you know, I don't want to use the cliche, but from like field to table or, you know, yeah. whatever. And it adds into the validity of the whole thing. I don't think there's many people that set out to be like, I'm going to go cook this frozen piece of thing that I found in the back of the freezer very passionately. Yeah. So that's awesome that you were able to make that connection. And I guess how did it continue to grow, and how did you foster that growth with both the culinary side of things and your hunting?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the early days when I was an apprentice, I didn't have a lot of free time. So, you know, as you guys are, I'm sure, you know, opening day, we're out there, you know, we've been practicing and everything else. I remember, you know, missing half a turkey season because I was working. And mm-hmm. if I got to go one or two weekends, it was, you know, a real kind of luxury. So, you know, in the early days, it was definitely harder to get out. And even when I opened Antler 5 years ago, it was very difficult to get out. And now as the restaurant is under control, I'm able to spend more time with my family and get outside some more. And the more time I spend out in the outdoors, the less time I want to spend at work in the kitchen. So it's
that's fair.
It's a very difficult you know, kind of place to be, but because I love both worlds. But you know, I think it's time for me now. You know, I've devoted my life to restaurants. You know, since I was 13 years old, it's you know, I really want to focus on myself and my family now.
Nice. That's awesome. So looking back, and you mentioned Antler, 5 years now, is that that's what you said? Yeah. Congrats. Yeah. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. So what happened, you know, I was working for other people, you know, all my life, and, getting into hunting and foraging and wanting to work with wild foods. You know, a lot of owners of restaurants where I worked were sort of less receptive. You know, once in a while we could do a feature with game, mm-hmm. but I wanted to put game on the menu, and that was always an issue. The owner didn't want it or thought people wouldn't like it. Or, you know, the last restaurant I worked at before Antler, actually said that we don't want PETA protesters outside. funny enough, it came true for me at Antler, but, yeah, he kind of called it. But, so that was really, I was just, you know, wanting to cook, you know, my food, the food that I wanted to cook and serve. And that's sort of how Antler started. along with, you know, wanting to do a cookbook about wild game, because everyone I spoke to in the city where I lived and my family and friends, everyone I spoke to about hunting wanted me to either take them with me or just talk to them about hunting or teach them about hunting. I thought it'd be a really good time to write a cookbook about the subject.
Yeah.
And that, you know, working on that cookbook, writing the cookbook, kind of snowballed and turned into a restaurant at the same time.
That's good. It's two birds, one stone.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of, you know, canceled. The restaurant really took over. And that's why it took 10 years to write the book, is because we put it on hold for about 3 years while we opened the restaurant. So
it's fair, but it gives you a good test bed to test new recipes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned I wasn't going to touch on it much, but you mentioned it, the PETA protesters. Yeah. I'm sure you get this question a lot about like how that story and how it played out. I've seen a lot of the videos and I've seen your other interviews, but I don't know that all of our listeners have.
Yeah. So I think we had been open for about 2 years, and you know, just so everybody knows, you know, we don't claim that we hunt what we, you know, what we serve or anything like that. All our meat, just like the States, has to be farmed. And we buy from local game farms, and we serve, the restaurant's called Antler. And we serve, you know, whatever would be wild and growing locally in Canada and where we live. So we buy local wild fish from all the Great Lakes and all three coasts. And we buy deer from, you know, deer, duck, rabbit, wild boar, from Ontario, and our bison comes from Alberta. So we're very local. And one day a staff member wrote on our chalkboard sign that we put on the street, "Venison is the new kale." And, you know, it was kind of during that big kale craze a few years ago that it's the healthiest plant on earth. And a cyclist rode by that was a member of a PETA organization that would go to slaughterhouses and protest the killing of animals and things like that. So she took offense and brought her little troop down to my restaurant and protested our building once a week for 11 months.
Wow.
And after about 3 months, I got completely fed up and pissed off, and we got whole deer delivered once a week. So I took a back leg and threw it in the window on a cutting board and decided I was going to joint this thing and break it down in front of them as a great big FU, back at them. So, they filmed it, put it online, and it just absolutely exploded in every sense of going viral. The last time I even looked, it was 25 million views on the Daily Mail Facebook page. And it went worldwide. We were getting articles sent to us from Russia, France, England, South Africa, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia. Almost every news outlet in the United States contacted us.
Wow.
And across Canada. It was just bizarre, completely bizarre. And yeah, we got an outpour of support for us, which was the really touching part of it all. You know, and what these people were doing just wasn't inspiring anybody. It was just malicious. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were good, honest, hardworking people that had a small family run restaurant, you know, just trying to do the right thing. And you know, they didn't feel that it was in line with their beliefs and try to change everyone else's beliefs. And you know, the support for us was, far greater than I would have ever imagined.
That's awesome. Yeah. I remember seeing that, and that was one thing that came to mind, and I was like, I hope that there is a positive side of this for you and for the restaurant.
Yeah.
Versus the possibility of negatives that it could bring, because, you know, like you said, you guys are just trying to do what's right and, you know, honoring the food and taking, you know, it'd be different if these people were protesting an institution that was not doing good things, they're not trying to do the right thing, and people may be more on board, but I don't know.
And we found out that that's actually their game plan, is they, you know, they know from experience that protesting outside of McDonald's and Harvey's or you know, fast food joints. Nobody cares. And mm-hmm. the people that are going there don't care. And people driving by don't care because everybody knows it's shit. So they purposely target little family places because they preach this thing they call the humane meat myth that, you know, killing of an animal at the end of the day is still murder and it's wrong. So, you know, and I've talked about this before, and if, you know, I think we have a lot of beliefs in common with vegans, and that's, you know, I don't want to see animals harmed either. And if they wanted to talk to me about, you know, reform for slaughterhouses or reform for factory farming with the government, you know, I would support them. Yeah. You know, and that's why I hunt, because I don't really believe in a lot of the factory farming practices that are going on in our world. But you know, they're not interested in having intellectual dialogue. They want you to conform to their belief and mm-hmm.
In an instantaneous manner.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I don't think eating a vegan diet is healthy for everybody either. You know, it might mm-hmm. work for some people, but it doesn't work for a lot of people, you know, in a physical sense. So, so anyway, that's the story in a nutshell.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
We've been talking a lot. Oregon, where Colin is at, has a group that's proposing this. It's a petition now.
Petition initiative, okay. I think. Right? PI-13 or IP-13.
Yeah, initiative petition, that's right. IP-13, and they're trying to get it on the ballot to basically make it a crime to do any harm to any animal in the entire state of Oregon. And sort of their whole philosophy is, if you go and you dig into their like Q&A section of their website, which I did because I wrote a nice little article on it, but they have this concept of where the agriculture system will just balance itself out. And it's like, well, we won't have meat, but we've got all these other great things that'll make up for it after that. And I was like, you know, I'm not a fan of the factory farming, but you have local farmers and ranchers that are doing good things and trying to mm-hmm. do the right thing. And like,
yeah.
like to me, that type of concept doesn't seem to fit well.
No. And you know, to live off a vegan diet, they need to factory farm soybean. They have to farm, you know, vegetables. That's, you know,
mass agriculture
called monocropping and things like mm-hmm. that has, you know, negative side effects for the planet as well. So yeah, it's just a very ignorant belief, you know, unless you have a garden and you're growing all your vegetables yourself and everything else. But you know, eating I've done some like vegan cleanses and things like that to try and be healthy and whatever. Yeah. And I've gone to vegan restaurants with friends and stuff like that, and I'm just not full after eating. I could eat the biggest plate of vegetables and rice and anything else you could think of and put that on there, and half an hour later, I'm starving again. And it just, it goes right through my body. It doesn't sit well in my stomach. And it's just, it doesn't sit well with me. And I've actually kind of researched a little bit. There's a book called, I think it's Eat for Your Blood Type or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of that.
And, you know, people with an O negative blood type need lots of meat protein, which, you know, I am, need lots of iron, need lots of, you know, vitamins and minerals that come from meat. So, you know, I don't really believe that a vegan lifestyle is healthy for everybody, mm-hmm. You know, which is a problem if they think that, you know, you need to cancel eating meat and fish, you know, over the entire world. there was scenarios in Canada when the government was giving Inuit populations in the Arctic beef to eat instead of whale. And the people weren't warm in the winter because they weren't eating whale blubber. That was something they had eaten for centuries. Mm-hmm. And beef fat didn't have the same kind of nutrients in it to keep them warm. So, you know, I think that, you know, making, you know, humans eat whatever, you know, you think they should eat doesn't really work for the entire world and geographically yeah. wherever you're from. So,
yeah. And, you know, physically, culturally, those things have evolved. Our bodies have evolved over time, depending on where you're at, to eat certain things, just as you mentioned. And I think about the Native Americans in the States and how the entering of like rations of coffee and flour and sugar and all that. And now, years down the road, you see high levels of diabetes because those things are still provided to reservations of Native American communities in the form of commodities. And it's just like, right. you still get those products now. And we know that they're not great for you, but what yeah. choice do you have? And yeah. so, yeah, it's an interesting, man, we could go down.
It's complicated. It's, yeah. yeah. It's so complicated. And the funny thing is, you know, I saw something online recently, and it was like a combine that had, you know, harvested a whole bunch of wheat, and in the back, you know, was like thousands and thousands of like grasshoppers that were jumping around inside, mm-hmm. you know, the trailer of this combine that were half chewed up and spat out. And wow. it was like, you know, like just because you're eating a grain, you don't think you're doing damage to animals or insects, but you know, they just slaughtered hundreds of thousands of grasshoppers in this field, you know, let alone yeah. rabbits or fawns or mice and whatever else is living in that field is getting chewed up by this combine. You know, there's blood on their hands, whether they know it or not.
It's great. It makes me think about, I was watching, it was a YouTube video from somewhere, but it was about, I think it was an African-American family in Central Florida, where they were doing sugar cane. So they grow a lot of sugar cane there. And, as they would go out and as they were cutting the sugar cane, they would run alongside whatever tractor device that they're using to cut it with. And the rabbits would run out and they would run alongside and they would club the rabbits. And then they would take the rabbits home with them. And it's just like this whole, you know, that's you're buying sweetener for your coffee and someone's knocking off rabbits.
Yeah,
same concept. Yeah. yeah. So it just goes to show you the complexities definitely in our food yeah. system. And just because, you know, like you said, unless you're growing it yourself.
I heard something about rice fields where they were as wild rice fields and they were shooting like thousands of ducks to protect these rice crops.
Yeah. Like, same concept.
You know, people don't know this, doesn't talk about this stuff.
Well, but it's probably some delicious duck though.
Yeah.
Mike, I don't know if you have any experience with nutria, but I'm doing the same thing with nutria out here.
Okay. Like, I don't know what nutria is.
They're like a little, well, they're invasive, but they're they're like right in between a muskrat and a beaver. But they're introduced.
Okay.
I don't know. I can see Justin smirking a little bit. I talk about it like every time I'm on here. They're highly invasive. They're brought in for the fur trade in like the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Okay.
And when the fur trade collapsed in the 40s, they basically just got released. So they're all over the American South and then this little tiny pocket of Northwest Oregon where I live.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Which so, I'm still baffled how they got to that one small area of yeah, of Oregon.
Let them go.
Yeah.
Farm let them go.
I think that was actually the case. I think there were a yeah. couple muskrat farms around here or something, muskrat fur farms, and yeah, they just let them go. I mean, they're in Europe, they're in Japan, there's like a little pocket in Africa. I think they were all introduced to. But I mean, same thing. We go out there with buddies and shoot them, but I mean, we're still taking them home and doing something with them, you know, helping out the farmers with their fields and then, you know, cooking them, mm-hmm. making hats out of them. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, hats on the wall.
I'm going to Google that. I have no idea what this looks like.
Oh, they're gross looking.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, they're, we had them. So when I went to college in New Orleans and we had them, they like would live in, you know, all over the place. You'd be like driving down the road and there'd be a, like a kind of a drainage with water in it, and they would be swimming around there. They're just like terribly, terribly invasive. There's a rumor, I don't know if it's true, but one of the sheriffs of one of the counties, the like parishes down there, back in, I think it was the 80s, would basically just encourage people to go drive around at night in their pickup trucks and just shoot nutria in the drainages all over town.
Yeah, just shine the headlights out of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Blind them.
That's so funny. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk a little bit about your cookbook. We can talk some recipes and stuff. So what kind of, we talked earlier about kind of what the restaurant and the book together, but what really laid the foundation for whenever you were like, I'm doing it, I'm going to write this cookbook, and how that all, how that work?
I think I just, you know, I kind of just touched on it earlier. It was, really my growing interest and obsession with the outdoors sort of just rubbed off on my family and friends, and everyone that, you know, I would speak to would ask me to talk to them about it or teach them or take them with me. And I just thought, you know, this would be a great idea for a cookbook. I worked for a famous chef at the time, Scott Conant out of New York. And when I started, he gave me his cookbook and handed it to me. And I kind of thought, you know, he's this big famous chef and he's all over TV, but he's really just a normal guy at the end of the day. And working for him, and at the same time getting more passionate about hunting, really was sort of the inspiration for the book. And, you know, I thought if, you know, Scott could do this, I could do this, you know? And I really just wanted to teach people about hunting and foraging, because in the city where I lived, it just seems it's totally forgotten about. So, I wanted to be a part of, re-educating people about where we came from.
And it's cool because you really go in great detail, the way the book's laid out as far as like large game, small game, fish forage, desserts, and cocktails too. That's all, I like the dessert part. I always like to see the dessert bit in there because, you know, hunters and anglers often don't think about the desserts coming from the wild.
Yeah, so. It's pretty neat. You can do a lot of stuff with, even today a friend of mine texts me, you guys might have it in some of the forest there. It's called Old Man's Beard, and it's kind of like a moss. And it's really good for starting fires. It's almost like birch bark. Yeah, Old Man's Beard. And I mentioned that to my friend. He goes, he's an indigenous chef. And he said, it's also great for tea. And I had no idea. And it's supposed to be good for like respiratory problems. And it's like a medicinal tea. And I'm like, well, I've been burning this stuff for years. So it was really just kind of interesting. And it's one of those things. It's just, the hunting, fishing, cooking, you know, it's just a never ending journey. Of knowledge, you know, and it's there's always little tricks and things to learn from friends and elders and other cultures. It's it's really just fascinating. And human civilization just has moved so far away from natural lifestyles. It's really fun just exploring all that again.
I agree completely, and it's neat. They have the ability to kind of build on stuff every day, and I look at it both from like a writing sense of where I'm trying to create content and write recipes and do that. But, you know, also day to day, I'm trying to feed my family in the same manner. And it's just like, sometimes you got to get a little creative while also, you know, stumbling onto something new, you know, like your friend mentioned, and just being super inspired to try it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm curious now. I'm going to have to go look this up just from our conversation here.
Yeah, it's all kinds of neat stuff we can do, and we try and use wild forage herbs and things like that in our cocktails at the restaurant too. There's all kinds of fun desserts you can make. One of them in there is wild ginger ice cream, which grows over a lot of Canada and the United States. Staghorn sumac we use a lot of in desserts and cocktails.
You have a cedar sorbet.
Yeah, and that's probably like the most basic thing that grows in, you know, everyone's backyard.
Yeah.
If you kind of research it, cedar tea was used for like early settlers to cure their scurvy, you know, when they're making the trip from, Britain and France to North America. So, And it was something that the natives showed them, you know, yeah, you don't have fruits and vegetables, but you can drink this cedar tea and it's full of vitamin C. So, yeah, there's you know, all kinds of things you can get creative with in the kitchen.
And it's cool, too, and you think especially a lot of the wild herbs and forageables, I guess that's a word. We'll make it a word today. But those items, you know, boil them in water, you know, stewing them or getting the sort of the essence out of them and then using mm-hmm. those to flavor other things.
Exactly.
You think of like spruce tips or
yeah.
I've got some jelly upstairs from Alaska. It's like spruce tip jelly, which is
that's
really
cool.
Great.
Yeah, I've seen spruce tip in beer now. Like it's becoming really popular. People are using pine cones.
There are two breweries mm-hmm. out here where I live that have rival spruce tip beers. They're both
nice.
Delicious.
That's so
but
cool.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
It's probably like the best thing to make.
Very
so
cool.
One thing I did want to talk about specifically, it's listed that caught my attention amongst other recipes in your book, is the moose tongue pastrami.
Yeah.
So how in the world did you settle on moose tongue pastrami?
Well, I mentioned earlier my background is English. So I remember mm-hmm. having jellied beef tongue as a kid and working in restaurants, beef tongue is used quite often. And I love it. I think, you know, I like eating all those, the offals, mm-hmm. you know, liver, heart, kidneys. And tongue is just one of those things that if it's cooked right, it's such a great protein. And, you know, now it's becoming a bit more expensive with supply and demand, but it used to be, you know, dirt cheap because nobody wanted mm-hmm. it. So the butchers were practically giving it away. You know, at the restaurant we've made, I think once there was a restaurant I worked at, we did a moose tongue, not a moose tongue, a beef tongue, pastrami sandwich with pretzel loaf bread oh, wow. and like sauerkraut and stuff like that. And I just, you know, everything that I hunt with, I try and incorporate it, you know, just like, I would beef or chicken or lamb, you know, you know, I found the moose tongue similar in size to a cow's, mm-hmm. And, you know, pretty similar in flavor. So I already had this tongue pastrami recipe and it was pretty, you know, for me, it was a natural
yeah.
kind of thing to eat, where some of my hunting buddies are like, I don't know about that. But, you know, now it's pretty funny now, you know, I've sort of earned their trust where if I bring something new, they'll just try it. So,
awesome.
But I remember one of my good friends that I still hunt with today, when we first met and started hunting, we were turkey hunting and he looked back and he couldn't see me. And I was like on my hands and knees picking morels. And he was like, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, he thought I was like, so crazy. He's like, we're hunting turkeys. He's on his hands and knees in the woods.
Gold mine over here.
Yeah. Well, we hit this huge patch and I gave him some to take home to his wife, or to cook. And his wife was like, there's no fucking way we're eating this with the kids. You know, like some guy you met said we could eat these mushrooms. And then now, you know, 10 years later, it's so funny. They popped up in his yard and they, you know, they eat them now. So it's pretty funny.
That's awesome. It's crazy. Morels. So we're still getting morels here in Colorado at various
wow.
elevations. Yeah.
Cool.
I joined one of the Facebooks of like mycological groups
yeah.
when I first got out here. And I love
yeah.
seeing the things.
They're
that
dangerous.
People post.
Those Facebook groups are dangerous.
Oh right? Yeah.
Those people are crazy.
I am very novice in the world of mushrooms and foraging, but man, it's cool to see some of the things that people like this. I saw it was just last night. This lady had a puffball that was
yep.
probably the size of like a large gym bag. And she just found it. She's like, it's already
yeah.
starting to yellow, so I can't eat it. But like, look
yeah.
at this thing. And she held it up and I was just like, this is
whoa.
Insane.
Yeah.
yeah. And it's just growing out there.
Yeah. There's a recipe in my book for a puffball carpaccio, which is kind
ooh.
Of fun.
Oh, nice.
That
so
is
like,
fun.
Yeah. yeah.
How did...
It works better if you have a vac pack, but you can, we sliced it thin, pickled it. And then, if you don't have a vacuum sealer, you can use a rolling pin and kind of squish it out.
Okay.
But we did like a super, you know, thin, like a beef carpaccio plate with arugula and Parmesan cheese and all that stuff, but with a puffball mushroom. It was really neat.
That's cool. And how's the? I've never had a puffball. How's the texture? Mm-hmm. Is it mushroomy as you would think?
Yeah, it's a little softer. Like the inside, it's like a, like a soft sponge almost inside. It just kind of sucks up whatever liquid you put on it. So when we slice it thin and basically pour boiling hot pickling liquid on it to kind of cook it. And then you, when you squish it out with a rolling pin, you kind of get more of a texture and flatten it, get all the air out and stuff. So
that's cool. Yeah. I'll have
but yeah,
to...
it's in there. It's in there in the, I think it's in the foraging section, but it's one of my kind of favorite fun recipes with puffballs.
I'm in a mushroom hotspot out here in Northwest Oregon, but I haven't really gotten into it like full blown where people are going out. And I mean, I guess like people travel from all over to come for chanterelle season.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I've just occasionally stumbled across some good ones. Like we found those oysters down in when we were bear hunting. Weren't quite sure what they were at first. Nice. Out of still service. Yeah. But I mean, I found a lobster mushroom up here.
Lobster mushrooms are one of my favorites too.
Yeah, the chanterelles in the spring are just, I mean.
There's a lobster mushroom bisque recipe in the book. And if you tell people it was shellfish, you know, they'd believe you. It's just, it tastes exactly like seafood. It's incredible.
Yeah. It was when I'm excited. I mean, this one was actually like laying on the trail that I was hiking on, but, I mean, it was very tender, very good.
Yeah.
Still
it's neat. It's funny. Like alive. When they start to rot, like when they're, if you don't find them quick enough, you can actually smell them. It just smells like a, you know, dead lobster somewhere. It's really funny. You can smell them in the woods.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
It's pretty crazy.
But I'm always, I train my eyes to always just, I'm always looking down like, oh, is there a morel over there or something? Yeah. Like always looking for stuff on the ground.
You gotta get, I made a commitment to myself, couple days ago, I got to get out and do some foraging as I'm out and about this fall. So,
Honestly, you'll find stuff just hiking, like just you know, take your friends or family for a hike and take the dog out, and you'll find something. It's if as long as you're looking for. Like I'll find chicken of the woods, these beautiful mushrooms, right beside trails, and people just have no idea what they are, and they you know, you're trained as a kid, don't eat things you don't know what they are, and so. I'll find morels on public walking trails. It's crazy.
It's actually
if you just look for it. If you just know what you're looking for, you know.
My kids just told me before I got on the podcast, I was cooking in the kitchen, and they're like, "Dad, there's a mushroom out here." I was like, "Don't touch it! Don't touch it! I'm gonna come out and see what it is." Yeah. And I completely forgot, but I'm gonna go follow up on this mushroom investigation after this. I did want to ask you about, in your book, you talk about the seared foie gras.
Yeah.
How does wild, goose liver compare to domestic?
So foie gras is, it's man-made. So, there would never be a case where you'd have it. It means fat liver. Mm-hmm. So what happens is an ancient kind of French practice, where they force feed ducks for their last, I think it's the last week of their life. And it creates, it's basically, the duck gets like a liver that's inflamed and sort of like the texture of, like butter is really like cold butter. So you can slice it into like large slices. And when you pan fry it, you get a really crispy, outer edge, almost like crispy, you know, chicken skin, but the inside is like almost like liquid kind of fat. It's a really rich kind of delicacy from France. So wild geese and duck livers are really just like a chicken liver from the store. That's the texture. You know, the only difference with foie gras is the feeding of the ducks at you know, kind of like when beef cattle are finished on grain. You
so
know,
should we be seeking out ducks from the local ponds here?
It's not the same thing. Their liver gets swollen because the amount of food that they're eating in like the last week of their life. So it's very similar to finishing a cow on grain kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's the difference between the you know a duck liver in the wild versus these farms and it's you know it has to be farmed. It's a practice that's like a man-made type of thing.
Interesting. I was just curious because I read the recipe. It's seared foie gras with foie gras biscuits and preserved cherries, and I was wondering, sort of if you went with a wild, but that makes total sense now. I'm glad I asked the question though.
It's really neat. It's you know their liver swells up you know, almost like five times the size of its normal liver. And it ends up being like, it almost looks like a pound of butter type of thing. And you cut it in slices.
It's so rich. I one of my, I think it was like my third or fourth restaurant I worked at. I worked at in San Diego at a place, Bankers Hill Way. It was on top of a building, like 20-story building. Yeah. And we made, for the happy hour menu, seared foie gras sliders. And I was like, this is just like the most rich, crazy thing
you just can melts think in of. Your mouth.
It's absolutely.
It's eating like a seared, it's like you took a slice of butter and like floured the edges and pan fried it. So it was kind of crispy on the outside, but like melting butter on the inside. Like it is it's a very rich, gluttonous product.
It was, it was delicious. And then California banned it.
Except
the only place you could buy it at was the gift shop at Yosemite National Park.
Okay.
Because it was federal land and they could sell it. Right. So they capitalized on that.
That's really funny. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people get upset about it. And I understand it. You know, there's more humane ways of producing it now. Mm-hmm. You know, the old days, they would use a metal funnel and ram it down the duck's throat and, you know, fill the duck up with grain. You know, now the practices are a lot different. There's more humane ways of doing it, but I think at the end of the day, it's still a man-made type of product.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's roll over to talk about your venison tenderloin with spice ash. What motivated you to start incorporating the ash and those products into some of your cooking?
Well, the spices, when you toast spices, it brings out their flavor a lot more. Mm-hmm. And the ash crust is one that was kind of, just kind of made by accident, you know, like he kind of, I toasted them too much and it was black, but not, if you burn it too much, you get like a white ash on it, which ends up being kind of gritty and there's no flavor. But if you toast everything till it's black, it really brings out like a really nutty flavor. And in that spice blend, it's sweet spices like cinnamon, clove, star anise, which is very licorice-y, allspice, clove. I don't know if I said that already. Fennel, things like that. So
and you're using whole versions of these, not like
whole spices. Yeah. So
if someone was to recreate it, it wouldn't be a powder.
Yeah. So you have to use whole spices. You burn it with the broiler in your oven, or you can toast it in a frying pan, but it does create a lot of smoke, so you got to have a good fan going. But so you toast it all till everything's black, and then you puree it through like a drink blender or like a Vitamix, and basically pulverize it to a powder, and then you sift it through a sieve, screen sieve, and you end up, it's almost like a coffee rub kind of texture, and it's just a very floral, it smells like Christmas in the air when you make it, it's just really wonderful with game meat. It goes really well with, you know, deer, elk, moose, things like that.
Nice. It sounds really good. Mm-hmm. And everybody loves the smell of Christmas, I guess.
It has a very floral, spicy. It smells like mulled wine almost.
I enjoy mulled wine. Yeah.
It smells like a holiday dish.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very fall oriented.
Like a mulled wine braised. Ooh. Might be onto something.
Yeah.
So what's one of your favorites from the book? Favorite recipe?
That spice ash you just mentioned is up there. I really like some of the cocktails. The ginger, wild ginger ice cream is incredible. There's a wild boar cavatelli pasta that is just incredible. It's basically just a collection of all my favorites. Each one of them is, I'm passionate about in some way or another, and has, you know, been important to me in the restaurants I've worked in and, things like that. So
it's awesome. It's like hearing the backstory to a song, you know, like your favorite album and
It's exactly like writing a menu is like writing an album. You know, there's things that you love that you put on the menu at the restaurant that people don't like or things like that. It's very funny. And you have your kind of like hits, you know, your hit singles on there. It's it's interesting.
Nice, like a set list. But So where all can everyone connect and purchase your cookbook at?
Oh, thanks. The cookbook is on my website, thehunterchef.com. There's a button on there for the store. So we ship those out of Canada. They are signed copies. But if it's easier, Amazon has it, Chapters Indigo, Bass Pro Shops has them in a lot of their locations. They were at, funny enough, they were at a few Costco's. Someone sent me a picture from Costco, Montana, or Bozeman. Oh, wow. I think Bozeman. Had one in,
yeah, that
in
makes
Montana.
Sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, they're very readily available online. So
nice.
And then, you know, social media wise, at the Hunter Chef, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff.
Nice. Awesome. Well, we're kind of like ramping down on time here. This is kind of the point in the show where we give everybody the opportunity to kind of give a last thought or alibi. So you being the guest, I would open it up if you have a last thought you want to leave us with.
I don't. I think we covered everything, man.
Nice. That's okay.
Oh, responsible foraging. Learn about, you know, if there's ramps. I think you guys call them ramps in the States. They don't grow back. So if whatever you're foraging, just kind of research what it is you're picking. Fiddleheads, same thing. You can't just pick them all from the plant or the plant dies. So make sure, you know, and also don't eat anything you're not 100% sure what it is. Because there's a lot of mushrooms out there that will kill you.
Yep.
It is no joke.
There's a lot of ones that
don't always trust everybody on the internet.
No, exactly. And I mean, stop messaging me pictures of mushrooms asking if you can eat them, because I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell people. Sometimes I'll respond and say, do you trust a stranger with your life? But you know, by the time you have a stomach ache, your liver is shutting down and it's too late. You're going to die. Ooh. So. It's
like a terrible way to go.
It's the worst way to go.
Ooh.
So,
all right, Colin, last thought, man.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for Michael for coming on. It was a really great talk. I really like the idea that you had with starting your restaurant and the cookbook. It's really something to look forward to and aspire to achieve those recipes. So if I'm ever in Toronto, I'm racking up a list of great restaurants from our podcast guests. And,
come on by, man.
Up in Toronto.
Love to have you.
I'm definitely swinging by. So thanks for coming
on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for coming on. It's definitely, I'll echo what Colin says. I'm excited. I'm going to try to plan a trip to Toronto now as soon as things improve. But
we're an hour from Buffalo. That's what I tell everybody.
Perfect.
Not far, yeah.
I can swing it. I got some friends that live in Buffalo, so we'll make it a 2-for-1 trip.
Corey's right down the road.
Yeah. It's just awesome. I'm going to take it on a tour, I guess.
Yeah.
Go stop by Niagara Falls and come to Toronto.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Taking the sights, see the family, visit friends, eat delicious food. Yeah. It's like that's the best trip.
Yeah.
So, well, I definitely enjoyed the conversation a lot. I think we hit a lot of good highlights, both in your cookbook and just sort of learning more about you and your experience in the outdoors. And we had some great conversations about food. So that's always exciting. I did make the mistake today is that I didn't eat before the show. So now I'm like starving. So I'm going to go deal with that after this. But
isn't that
I would tell
little,
anyone out there.
Our little intro for the show, it says like,
it's,
make
it's
sure
literally
you
in the intro. It's a few times that I failed to do it, but today is one such day.
Yeah.
We talked about delicious food, so it doesn't help. But I would say everybody go check out Michael's cookbook. I got a copy here with me, and I've been flipping through it. I love it. And go connect with him on social media if you're not. And then make sure you're following us over at Harvesting Nature too on whatever platform you're plugged into there, Instagram, Twitter, we're everywhere. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us what we're doing wrong, or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. And I say this, thanks everybody, have a good night.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.
Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Every Monday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.